In 1700, it took 19 farmers to feed one non-farmer, a guarantee that people who minded other people's business would only be an accent note in general society. 100 years later, England had driven its yeoman farmers almost out of existence, converting a few into an agricultural proletariat to take advantage of machine-age farming practices only sensible in large holdings. By 1900, one farmer could feed 19, releasing 8 men and women for disposal otherwise. Schools during this period, however, remained trapped in the way things used to be, unable to deliver on their potent inherent potential as massifiers. Between 1830 and 1840, the decade in which the Boston School Committee came into existence, a fantastic transformation built out of steam and coal became visible. When the decade began, the surface aspect of the nation was consistent with the familiar life of colonial times, the same relationships, the same values. By its end, modern American history begins. Chicago, a frontier fort in 1832, was by 1838 a flourishing city with 8 daily steamboat connections to Buffalo, the Paris of Lake Erie. But something to rival steam-driven transport in importance appeared at almost the same time: cheap steel. The embryonic steel industry, which had come into existence in the 18th century, revolutionized itself in the 19th, when the secret of producing steel cheaply was revealed. Formerly, steel had been bought dearly in small quantities by smelting iron ore with coke, converting the resulting iron pigs into wrought iron by puddling. This was followed by rolling and then by processing fine wrought iron through a further step called cementation. Steel made this way could only be used for high-grade articles like watch springs, knives, tools, and shoe buckles. The first part of the new steel revolution followed from the discovery of the Bessemer process in 1856. Now steel could be made directly from pig iron. In 1865, the Siemens-Martin open hearth technique gave a similar product of even more uniform quality than Bessemer steel. The next advance occurred in 1879, when Thomas and Gilchrist discovered how to use formerly unsuitable phosphoric iron ore, more common than non-phosphoric, in steelmaking, yielding as its byproduct valuable artificial fertilizer for agriculture. These two transformations made possible the substitution of steel for wrought iron and opened hundreds of new uses. Steel rails gave a huge push to railway construction, and structural steelwork marked a stupendous advance in engineering possibilities, allowing a radical reconception of human society. Capital began to build for itself truly global associations which made national sovereignty irrelevant for a small class of leaders as long as a century ago. And that fact alone had great relevance for the future of schooling. As steel articulated itself rationally, vertical integration became the order of the day. Iron and steel reached backward to control coal mines and coking plants, and forward to acquire rolling mills, plant mills, wire drawing facilities, galvanized iron and tin plate establishments, rod mills, etc. Small undertakings were sucked inexorably into large trusts. Every one of the most modern developments in technique and organization pioneered by steel was echoed in the new factory schools. Increase in the size of the plant, integration of formerly independent educational factors like family, church, library, and recreational facility into a coalition dominated by professional schooling, the specialization of all pedagogical labor, and the standardization of curriculum, testing, and acceptable educational behavior. What confused the issue for the participant population is that parents and students still believed that efficiency in the development of various literacies was the goal of the school exercise. Indeed, they still do. But that had ceased to be the purpose in big cities as early as 1905. Schooling was about efficiency. Social efficiency meant standardizing human units. Surprisingly enough, to those who expect that institutional thinking will reflect their own thought only on a larger scale, what is an asset to a mass production economy is frequently a liability to an individual or a family. Creating value in children for a mass production workplace through schooling meant degrading their intellectual growth and discouraging any premature utility to the larger society. Elwood P. Cubberley inadvertently spilled the beans in his classic Public Education in the United States when he admitted compulsion schooling would not work as long as children were allowed to be useful to the real world. Ending that usefulness demanded legislation, inspectors, stiff penalties, and managed public opinion. New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island led the charge to seal off the escape route of useful work for children, just as they once led the drive for compulsion schooling in the first place. The child labor rhetoric of the day was impressively passionate. Some of it genuinely felt and needed. But the cynical aspect can be detected in a loophole created for show business children, professional children, as they are called in the argot. Whether the work of a child actor is less degrading than any other kind of work is a question not difficult for most people to answer.